when they show you who they are with every breath and footfall. They are true to their own personality, spirit, and character. You can watch that person living all the life that is in them. It might be that they are a carpenter in a family of lawyers, or a midwife in a family of doctors. Maybe they found their own religious path, though they came from a non-religious family. Or maybe they dress in a way that expresses their creativity or defiance of authority or love of the unique. Maybe they dress like a girl when society thinks they aren't. You know these people. Heck, I strive to be one of those people. An authentic person may have broken with the dreams of their family, or even broken their parents' heart, at least for a bit, till the family reconciles themselves and sees that their loved one is so much happier with that purple hair, or living in a rustic cabin, or quitting their job to write their novel. Authenticity has something to do with today's sermon. I was raised some variant of Protestant, and back at the age of 6 or 7, I spent a lot of time worrying about children in the parts of the world where people weren't Christian. The kids in China, the kids in India, those were the ones that broke my heart at the time. And then I got the profound insight that people were around before Christ. The fact that people were around before the year 1 led me to expand my worry to include all of those people who were alive before Jesus' message was delivered. What about them? Was it at all fair that all of them were doomed to hell just because they were born at the wrong time or in the wrong place? I ultimately decided that God was too loving to give eternal damnation to those who didn't have a chance to listen to Jesus' message. I wasn't the only one worrying about that part of many people's fate. Universalists, that is to say the second you in Unitarian Universalists, were focused on who would be saved after death. Who would get to go to heaven and what heaven looked like. They concluded that all of us would be saved because of divine love and mercy. Every one of us, that is every last sinner, would be saved. Jane Lead worried about human fate after death too. Lead, which is sometimes written with an E at the end and sometimes not, worried about eternal damnation, and ultimately she wrote 19 books about that subject and her other theological concerns. What else was happening in 1681? Yes, 1681, when her first book was printed. James II was king of England, and there were 7 or so kings and a queen on the British throne before King George III, who we all know through the Revolutionary War. Indeed, in the 1680s, that was when William Penn received a royal charter to establish Pennsylvania. In other words, the 13 colonies weren't even in place. We're talking about a long time ago in 1681 in England, friends. What did Jane Lead believe? Well, she became a Christian universalist. In her words, she rejected the doctrine that hath been preached of an endless misery and torment, which had wrought little effect in frightening or terrifying them from their evil courses. Put in more modern day English, she did not believe that the church had a chance into frightening people into being good. She enjoined her people to wait together in the unity of pure love. She had a vision of the Virgin Sophia, the feminine aspect of God. Even today, many people can't get their mind around divinity and feminism in the same sentence. Divine feminine, feminine divine in the 1600s. Jane Lead even wrote about maternity and birth as aspects of the divine. She believed in continuing revelation through apparitions and visions, and she believed that individual religious experience was authentic enough to overwrite what scholars thought the Bible said. This woman was developing and writing about her fascinating and truly radical theology. Her books were translated into 4 languages. She had followers in many countries. She was financially supported by the kings of Brandenburg in Germany. Yes, those are the same kings of Brandenburg who funded Bach to write what we just heard a few years later. Yeah, a long time ago, friends. She had the same patron family as Bach, but before Bach. Jane Lead's publications influenced Quakers, Moravians, and Huguenots. There are some who worship a female deity who even today study her readings. And most of us have never heard of her. That's an interesting fact. And here is another interesting fact. She was well educated. You maybe guessed that. She was reportedly married happily to a cousin for 27 years. They had 4 children, and she didn't write a word for publication till he died. Not a word. She didn't write a word till she was 57 and blind. Jane Lead undoubtedly was a prophet. Yes, a forgotten one, but nevertheless a prophet. Who are our modern prophets? Who are prophets whose voices we want to hold on to? And yes, what does it take to be a prophet? Well, one thing it takes to be a prophet is an audience. People have to hear your words and wisdom and at least think about them a bit, preferably with an open mind. What we saw earlier, no prophetic voice was going to go through that. And now into the current day. Regarding listening, Rebecca Solnit, a multi-published author of the current day, says, "I still don't know why Sally and I bothered to go to that party in the forest slope above Aspen. The people were all older than us and dull in a distinguished way, old enough that we at 40-ish passed as the occasion's young ladies. The house, a rugged luxury cabin at 9,000 feet, we were preparing to leave when our host said, 'No, stay a little longer so I can talk with you.' He was an imposing man who'd made lots of money. He kept us waiting while the other guests drifted out into the summer night, and then he sat down in his authentically grainy wood table and said to me, 'So, I hear you've written a few books.' I replied, 'Several, actually.' He said, in the way that you encourage your friend's 7-year-old daughter to describe flute practice, 'And what are they about?' There were actually about quite a few different things, the 6 or 7 out by then, but I began to speak only of the most recent on that summer day. River of Shadows, Edward Muybridge, and the Technological Wild West. My book on the annihilation of time and space and the industrialization of everyday life. He cut me off soon after I mentioned Muybridge's name. And have you heard about the very important Muybridge book that came out this year? So caught up was I in my assigned role as ingenue that I was perfectly willing to entertain the possibility that another book on the same subject had come out simultaneously and I had somehow missed it. He was busy telling me about the very important book with that smug look that I already knew so well in a man holding forth, eyes fixed on the fuzzy horizon of his own authority. Here, Solnit says, let me just say that my life is well sprinkled with lovely men, with a long succession of editors who have, since I was young, listened and encouraged and published me. And I, Alexa, will say the same thing. Still, there are these other men, returning back to Solnit. So Mr. Very Important was going on smugly about this book I should have known when Sally, my friend, interrupted him to say, that's her book. Or tried to interrupt him anyway. But he just continued on his way. She had to say, that's her book, 3 or 4 times before he finally took it in. And then, as if in a 19th century novel, he went ashen. That I was indeed the author of the very important book it turned out he hadn't read, just read about in the New York Times book review a few months earlier, so confused his neat categories into which his world was sorted that he was stunned, speechless for a moment before he began holding forth again. I like incidents of that sort. When forces that are usually so sneaky and hard to point out slither out of the grass and are as obvious as an anaconda that's eaten a cow. That guy couldn't listen to a woman if his life depended on it, and surely not if she was younger than he. So now I ask you to please travel back in time and place with me from a modern lodge in Aspen to Jane Leeds, England. And yes, from here on, we're going beyond the facts and into my theories. Maybe these theories are wrongheaded, but I really want to know what happened to Jane Leeds to bring her into her authentic self, her preacher self, her prophetic self. There is an old story that has been told about a rabbi named Zusia. As Rabbi Zusia was dying, he told his students that he was very afraid. The students were shocked. They said, Rabbi, you have always told us that God is full of love and kindness. I am not afraid of God, said Rabbi Zusia. I know that God will not ask me why I was not Moses or Isaiah. I am afraid that God will ask me why I wasn't Zusia. I want to know how and when Jane Lead became Jane Lead. I want to know what prevented her from being Jane Lead earlier in her life. She didn't need to be Moses or Isaiah, but she did need to be Jane Lead in all of her prophetic wonderfulness. I don't think it's a coincidence that Jane Lead came into her own only after her husband died. There must be some connection between the two events. There could be a variety of interweavings of his death or maybe her blindness and her starting to write. Could it be that her loss of sight propelled her visions, which were at the basis of her prophecy? She doesn't say so, and I'm guessing that she would if she thought that that was what had happened. Could it be that she was impoverished and desperate financially, with children at home and no way to earn a living? Every biography talks about how dire her financial reality was. In her desperation, did she create words and visions to pay the bills? Did her financial desperation break open her relationship with God so that she had new, never thought words in her head coming out of her hand onto the page and ultimately into writing she had to share with the world? Maybe. Maybe she lacked a community when her husband died, and something in her marriage prevented her from joining or forming a community. That's possible. Or was her husband the same sort of man as the guy in Aspen? the man she cuddled with in bed and shared deep ideas with, and who responded by saying that someone else had written that book, the one she wanted to write. There was no need for her to write it, that maybe it was even embarrassing to him to think of her name, his last name, on a book whose quality, scholarship, radicalism, and prophecy he did not trust. Maybe he couldn't trust her thoughts because her vision included a female divine. She saw birth, a dirty thing in people's mind at the time, as sacred. Perhaps he just talked over her for 27 years. Maybe. Of course, we can't know why Jane Lead published only after her husband's death. But we know that huge numbers of opera singers, doctors, lawyers, politicians, brilliant scientists, and prophetic preachers were never allowed to come up because they were women. By and large, since written history, female people weren't allowed to contribute to society in the way that they could have. They were married women, single women, women with children or women without children, all not worth listening to in most people's eyes. Women have been silenced, disempowered, called a witch, and killed for being a she-devil. Being an authentic woman has always been hard across the centuries, and being listened to has been a rare thing for women across time. What prophets aren't we hearing now, today, because we are talking over them, or someone is talking over them, or they don't feel empowered enough to even speak? When are we putting ourselves and our vision of the truth at the center of the story instead of listening to someone with a different point of view? Maybe a very different point of view. What allows us to listen to the prophetic voice of others? What I am saying is, listen to the disempowered. Don't be like that guy in Aspen. Don't be like I personally think Jane Lead's husband and community probably were. Listen for the wisdom of the unheard. Listen for the prophetic voices of the marginalized, disregarded, and disrespected. Listen. Listen.